Mr. Hansen Podcast. The man who couldn't play guitar. The rise of Leo Fender. It's late. Not the kind of late where people are heading home. Nah, this is the kind of late where the room stops pretending to be ordinary. The kind of late where the air gets heavier. Where cigarette smoke curls beneath the lights like it has nowhere better to go. Where the glasses behind the bar don't clink anymore, they whisper. Where low conversations drift from table to table, half hidden under the smell of whiskey and dust and old wood and electricity. Now the room is small, not fancy, not polished, not built for greatness. The floor sticky in places. The walls are stained with years of laughter and arguments, heartbreak and music. Somewhere in the corner, a jukebox hums itself like an old man trying to remember the words. And then, something changes. Not all at once, not dramatically, but just enough. Enough that the man at the bar stops lifting his glass. Enough that the couple in the back booth stop whispering. Enough that the drummer on the little stage turns his head. The lights dim a little, then a little more. And suddenly the room is no longer a bar. It's transformed into a theater, a chapel, a waiting place. A single spotlight flickers on above the stage. And there, leaning against an amplifier, is a guitar. Not like the guitars the room remembers. Not curved with old-world elegance. Not hollow and warm and delicate. This one is different. This one is sharper. It's cleaner, almost industrial. It looks less like something carved by tradition and more like something drawn on a drafting table by a man who didn't care whether tradition approved or not. It's solid and plain and unapologetic. A tool pretending to be an instrument. A machine just waiting for its opportunity to sing. A musician steps forward. No introduction, no huge announcement. No big smile to the crowd. He just walks towards the guitar like he already knows something the rest of the room doesn't. He picks it up. The strap slowly settles over his shoulder. The cable slides into the jack with that small click. Then the amp wakes up. A low hum begins to rise. Not loud, not yet. Just a simple warning. Just electricity clearing its throat. The musician places his hand on the neck. The room leans in. And then, one note. Not a flourish, not a solo, just one note. It cuts through the room clean. No wobble and no howl. No collapsing into feedback. It lands exactly where it's supposed to land. Then another note. Then a chord. And the room changes shape. The sound does not beg to be heard. It commands it. You see, it is bright without being thin. Sharp without being weak. Controlled without being small. It slices through the smoky room. Through the glasses, through the murmurs, through every old assumption about what a guitar is supposed to be. And nobody in that room knows it yet, but they're hearing the future. A future built by a man who did not perform under spotlights. A man who simply didn't chase applause. A man who did not stand on stage and bend strings until the crowd screamed his name. No, that sound was built by a man in a work shirt, with a pencil and a glass eye, with a pocket protector, with a mind that saw music not as romance, but as simply a problem that's waiting to be solved. You see, that sound was built by a man who couldn't play guitar. Most people build from experience in playing. The ones who change everything, they build from obsession. Act 2, The World Before Him. Before Leo Fender, guitars were not machines. They were more like heirlooms. They were a craft. They were carved and shaped and handled with reverence. A guitar had curves because tradition said it should. It had a hollow body because that was how sound took a breath. It had the smell of lacquer and wood and old world patience. It belonged to a lineage. It came from a world where instruments were not assembled and they were born. And for a long time, that was simply enough. In quiet rooms, it worked. In parlor music, it worked. In small ensembles, it worked. A guitar could sit in a room and just speak gently. It could accompany a voice. It could fill the spaces between the words. But then music started changing. The rooms grew larger. The bands got bigger. The crowds got louder. Drums began hitting harder. Horn sections blasted like traffic and dance halls filled with bodies. Country bands and swing bands and western bands, traveling acts, nightclub players, all of them pushed volume higher and higher and higher. And the guitar started losing the fight. Oh, it was beautiful, but it was fragile. It was, in certain ways, respected, but it was definitely limited. Hollow body guitars fed back when amplified. They warped in the heat and they cracked, and they were hard to repair when you're on the road. They were inconsistent from one instrument to the next. One guitar might feel perfect and the next might feel like you're having an argument with it. And musicians, well, they knew it. They knew it when they fought to be heard over the brass section. They knew it when a pickup buzzed at the worst possible moment. They knew it when their instrument screamed with feedback during a set. They knew it when the body dug into their ribs. They knew it when one night the guitar felt alive and the next night it felt like they betrayed them. But no options, most people just accepted it because that was the instrument. That was the world. That was their bargain. A guitar was simply a guitar. So you learn to live within its limits. But Leo Fender, he didn't come from that world. He didn't approach the guitar like a musician did. He approached it like a man staring at a machine that had not been built correctly. And that is a strange gift of the outsider. Insiders know what is sacred. Outsiders see what is broken. The Barn. August 10th, 1909, Southern California. Not the California freeways and film premieres and sunlit subdivisions. Not yet. This is a California of ranch land, of citrus groves, of dusty roads and work trucks. Of families measuring their lives in seasons and harvests and weather. And what could be fixed before supper? A barn stands between Anaheim and Fullerton. Not a hospital, not a clean white room, a barn. Wood walls and hay and warm air. The smell of oranges drifting in from outside. A kerosene lamp flickered low in the corner and a mother in pain. A father nervously waiting. And then a baby boy enters the world. Clarence Leonidas Fender. The world will eventually call him Leo. His father is Clarence Monty Fender, known as Monty. His mother is Harriet. They grow vegetables, melons, and oranges. They sell produce out of a truck in Long Beach. They're not wealthy by any stretch of the imagination. They're connected. They're not really famous. They're not musical royalty. They're blue-collar working people. And working people have a way of teaching lessons without announcing them. You know, if something breaks, fix it. If you need something, build it. If you cannot afford new, make the old work longer. If you do not know how something works, well, then you take it apart and you learn. That was Leo Fender's first school. Not a conservatory, not an engineering college. A ranch and a truck and a barn. A family that couldn't afford to waste anything. And from the time he could hold a tool, Leo seemed less interested in what things were and more interested in what they were hiding. You see, a radio was not a box. It was a mystery with screws in the back. A clock was really not a clock. It was gears and springs and in order. A machine was not something to use. It was something to understand. His mother might find him on the floor with parts spread out all around him, and tubes, wires, screws, and casings. Everything carefully placed in rows like he was presenting evidence. Another child might break something in panic. Leo dismantled things with the seriousness of a surgeon. He wanted to know where the life was, where the current was moving, where the signal traveled, you know, where the sound came from. And maybe that's where the story truly begins. Not with guitars, not with amplifiers, but in a quiet place, not with fame, but with a quiet boy on a floor staring into the open back of a radio, trying to understand how a voice could travel through the air and arrive inside a box. Because Leo Fender was never satisfied with hearing sound. He wanted to know how sound moved. The glass eye. When Leo was 8 years old, life made its first serious demand. A tumor grew behind his left eye. Now, there are moments in a child's life that split time in two, you know, the before and the after. This was one of them. Doctors, whispers, adults trying not to look frightened, a little boy old enough to understand fear but too young to understand fate. The eye, it had to be removed. Think about that for a second. 8 years old, a child's body still small. A child's world still mostly made of family and chores and school and their awesome imagination. And suddenly, he is introduced to the loss in the most physical way possible. The eye is simply gone. A glass eye takes its place. You see, Leo would live the rest of his life with one natural eye and one made by human hands. He did not make a public tragedy out of it. He didn't turn it into some performance. He simply carried it. But the body remembers what the mouth refuses to say. A boy who loses an eye learns something about limitation. He learns that the world can change without asking permission. He learns that what is missing can become a part of how you move. He learns to compensate and to measure, to adjust, and to just become precise. Then 25 years later, that glass eye would change the course of music. Because when the United States went to war, the military looked at Leo Fender and passed him over. One good eye, a glass eye in the other socket, not fit for service. And while other men shipped out, while other engineers and mechanics and young minds were pulled into the machinery of war, Leo Fender stayed in Fullerton. Now, at the time, it may have felt like rejection or limitation or just another fact of life. But history has a way of hiding doorways inside disappointments. Because the man who stayed home would have had something almost nobody else had. And that was simply time. And Leo Fender would use every minute of it. The first signal. Before the shop, before the factory, before the guitars, before the name Fender became stamped onto headstocks around the world, there was a teenage boy sitting in his uncle's auto electric shop. His uncle, John West, well, he had a place in Santa Maria. And the shop smelled of motor oil and copper and hot metal, dust, and most importantly, possibility. You see, this was not a music store. This was not a stage. This was a room where electricity was treated like a living thing. Wires ran like veins through the wall. Tools hung on the wall on top of it. Parts sat in bins. A workbench held the kind of small miracles most people walk past without even understanding. And it was there, one day, Leo saw a homemade radio. You see, his uncle had built it from spare parts. Now, to most people, it might have looked crude. To Leo, it was magic with rules. His uncle plugged it in, turned a dial, static and hiss, a crackle, and then a voice out of nowhere, like magic. A human voice arriving from distance, carried by some invisible force. Leo stared. He didn't even move. He didn't speak. The world had opened. Not emotionally, but technically. A voice could be captured and a signal could travel. Electricity could carry presence. Sound could be moved. Sound could be shaped. Sound could be delivered. In that moment, it mattered. Because Leo Fender was not drawn to music the way musicians are drawn to music. He was not seduced first by melody. He was seduced by transmission, by the miracle of something leaving one place and arriving in another, invisibly. By the idea that sound was not merely heard, that it could be carried, it could be strengthened and controlled. And when he returned home, he began drawing. Schematics and circuits and diagrams. Some of them he didn't even understand yet. But that never stopped Leo Fender. Understanding for him was not a prerequisite. It was the destination. By his teenage years, he was preparing radios in his parents' home. He built his own radio. Gave it a call sign, W6DOE. He picked up signals from across California, from across the desert and from the coast, from ships off San Diego. Faraway voices arriving in his room through wires, tubes, and simply patience. He took piano lessons. He took saxophone lessons. He played in the school band. But he never became good enough for music to claim him as one of their own. And maybe that mattered. Because if Leo Fender had become a great player, he might not have spent his life chasing notes. Instead, he chased the thing underneath the note. The current. The signal. The system. For Leo Fender, music was not something you made with your fingers. Music was something that moved through wires. Fender's Radio Service. Leo graduates from Fullerton Union High School in 1928, then Fullerton Junior College. His major? Accounting. Not electrical engineering, not music, but accounting. The man who would help define the sound of modern music studied bookkeeping. There is something perfect about that, because Leo Fender would never be the romantic version of some crazy inventor. He was not the wild-haired shouting into the night. He was not a reckless genius throwing sparks across a room. He was methodical. Leo Fender was careful and practical. He could count. He could organize. He could read a problem and break it into pieces. He never took a formal course in electrical engineering. Not one. He simply learned it himself. At benches, in garages, at night, through mistakes and shocks and through diagrams, through burned fingers and failed circuits and stubborn discipline of trying again. In 1934, he married Esther Klosky. Esther would become part of the machinery of his life in ways history sometimes just underplays. You see, she was not merely a wife waiting at home, because she worked beside him. She stood at counters. She handled customers. She endured long hours and strained schedules and financial pressure and a husband whose mind rarely left the bench. Leo worked as a bookkeeper for an ice company, then a tire company. You know the kind. A stable man, a practical man. A man who might have spent his whole life keeping books for somebody else. Then in 1938, the tire company changed management, and Leo Fender lost his job. There are men who become smaller when the world pushes them. But Leo Fender, he became more focused. Well, he had no job. A wife, no engineering degree, no famous name. But that man had skill. He had patience. And he had a Ford Model A that he could borrow against. $600. You see, that's what stood between Leo Fender and the rest of his life. So he borrowed it. He opened a shop at 112 South Spadra Avenue in Fullerton, California. A storefront the size of someone's kitchen. A hand-lettered sign in the window. Fender's Radio Service. Specializing in every branch of sound. Now that phrase, it mattered. Every branch of sound. Radios and phonographs and public address systems and car radios and amplifiers. If sound traveled through the wires, Leo Fender, yeah, he wanted to touch it. He drove a sound truck around town, renting it to political candidates and civic events. He repaired what people brought him. He built what people needed. He opened the door each morning and worked. Now, it was not glamorous, and it was not famous. It wasn't even destiny, yet. It was a man in a small shop trying to make enough money to just keep going. Then the Santa Ana River flooded. Water rose and the shop filled. His equipment soaked, inventory completely ruined. Parts that represented survival were suddenly under muddy water. Picture this in your mind. Leo Fender standing over there, looking into the flooded shop, seeing not just water, but borrowed money and risk, future, and all of his work dissolving in front of him. Most men would have called it a sign. Leo Fender, he got into a kayak. He paddled through the floodwater and saved what he could. Then he simply dried parts one by one. He cleaned and rebuilt and then reopened. Because that is what Leo Fender did when something broke. He didn't hold a funeral for it. He simply fixed it. The musicians come in. By the early 1940s, Fender's Radio Service had become a place that musicians knew. If an amplifier failed, well, they brought it to Leo. If a pickup was buzzing wrong, well, they brought it to Leo. If a microphone would not carry, well, they brought it to Leo. The bell over the door rang constantly and consistently. Esther worked the front, Leo worked the back, a pencil behind his ear and a schematic on the bench. Vacuum tubes glowing on a shelf. The smell of, the smell of solder and dust and coffee and hot circuitry hanging in the air. They came from dance halls, from Western swing bands, from country groups, from Hawaiian lap steel acts, from big bands and small bands and road bands that lived out of cars and played rooms where the pay was low and the expectations were high. And they complained. They complained because musicians always complain. Now the amp feeds back, the pickup buzzes, the cable crackles, the guitar will not stay in tune, the sound disappears under the horn section, the bass cannot be heard past the third row. The body is awkward, the neck is wrong, the night is long. The instrument, it just keeps biting me. And Leo listened, carefully. I think that was his superpower, not charisma, not stage presence, but extreme listening. But he didn't listen like a performer. He listened like a mechanic hearing an engine knock. He listened for repeated failure, for patterns, for the part of the story each musician did not know that they were actually telling him. And slowly, a truth formed in his mind. These were not separate complaints. They were connected. The instruments were not built for the new world musicians where they were entering. The music was becoming louder, more electric and more mobile, simply more demanding. But the looks were still carrying old assumptions. Leo Fender did not see sacred tradition. He saw inefficiency. He saw parts that could be improved. He saw a system begging to be redesigned. Doc Kaufman and the War Years. In 1943, a man named Clayton Orr Kaufman walked into Fender's radio service. Everyone just called him Doc. Doc Kaufman was a musician, a lap steel player, a street performer, and kind of a tinkerer. He had worked at Rickenbacker. He had helped invent the Vibrola tailpiece. In other words, he was one of those rare men who lived in the overlapping world between music and machinery. But he understood players. Leo understood electronics. When Doc walked into Leo's shop, the country was at war. Pearl Harbor was behind them. Factories across Southern California were running day and night. The country was building aircraft parts and parachute fabric, instruments and buckles and uniforms, engines and tools of survival. Many of the men Leo might have competed with were just gone, drafted and assigned and shipped out. Leo remained in Fullerton because the military did not want a man with one working eye. And there, in that small shop, while the world burned across the oceans, Leo Fender kept repairing radios and building amplifiers, studying musicians and drawing. Doc walked in with the ideas. Leo looked up from the bench. Two men, one workbench, one conversation that would not really end for a couple years. They formed the K&F Manufacturing, Kaufman and Fender, 1945. Their first product was a lap steel guitar sold with an amplifier. Now that matters, because before Leo Fender became a guitar man, he was already thinking in systems. Instrument plus amplifier. Player plus electricity. Sound plus delivery. Not one thing, but the whole chain. Doc Kaufman, well, he eventually left. He worried the business would fail. He worried about the demand. He worried about the uncertain post-war market. Leo didn't argue. He shook his hand, wished him well, and just did what he always did. Kept drawing. You see, that is one of the keys to Leo Fender. He was not dramatic about continuation. He simply did it. Continued. K&F became Fender Manufacturing. Then Fender Electric Instrument Company. By late 1947, there was a factory across the Fullerton train station. A new hire named George Fullerton came in, a truck driver and a weekend guitarist. You know, a practical, useful man. And Leo's drafting table began filling with drawings of something that seemed almost offensive in its simplicity. A guitar shaped like a tool. A guitar with no hollow body. A guitar with a bolt-on neck. You know, a guitar with replaceable parts. A guitar that was designed not to be worshipped, but actually used. Night after night, room after room. No warping, no fighting, no mystery, no. Just a machine for musicians. The prototype. 1948, Fullerton, California. Leo Fender is 39 years old. Glass eye, pencil in hand, drafting table in front of him. George Fullerton nearby, a piece of ash wood on the bench. Sawdust filled the air. A radio playing low in the corner. And Leo draws a flat slab body, a single cutaway, a bolt-on neck, a bridge with adjustable saddles, a pickup wound to his specifications. He does not carve it like a violin. He does not pretend it is something from another century. He does not hide the fact that it's industrial. He cuts it flat like a board, like a counter. Like something built by a man who would rather solve a problem than win some sort of beauty contest. Now the prototype, it looks ugly, it looks unfinished, and it looks completely wrong. But Leo Fender does not care what it looks like. He cares what it does. He hands it to musicians, tells them, you know, take it home, play it. Bring it back if something breaks. And they do. They play it in clubs and in dance halls and honky-tonks under hot lights. In rooms full of smoke and sweat and bodies. And they come back. And Leo does what he does best. He listens. Well, the pickup needs more bite. The bridge needs adjustment. The body feels strange, but the sound cuts. The feedback is better. The instrument works. Leo makes some changes and hands it out again. And that is the genius of the man. Most inventors fall in love with their own idea. Leo Fender fell in love with the correction. He built in a feedback loop. Musicians thought they were testing a guitar. They were actually helping design the future. In April 1950, the Fender Esquire went on sale. One pickup. $154.95. Then came the two-pickup version, originally called the Broadcaster. Until Gretsch sent a telegram reminding Fender they owned the name Broadcaster for a line of drums. Leo did not make a grand legal war out of it. He simply just removed the name. Some guitars shipped with no model name on the headstock. Collectors would later call them no-casters. Then came the new name, Telecaster. The first mass-produced solid-body electric guitar in history. And here is the beautiful tension of it. 2,000 miles east in Kalamazoo, Gibson had Les Paul's log idea sitting in memory like an embarrassment. They had dismissed it. A broomstick with pickups. Too strange, too ugly, just too much. But Leo Fender was not asking permission from tradition. He was shipping guitars. A man who could not play guitar had just forced the guitar industry to move. The Telecaster found its earliest believers in country players, Western swing musicians, and honky-tonk pickers. The sound cut through a noisy bar like a blade through cloth. It did not fight the brass, it simply passed it. It did not disappear behind drums, it stood there, clear and bright, defiant. Then in 1951, Leo Fender just did it again. The precision bass. The first mass-produced solid-body electric bass guitar. For generations, bass players had hauled upright basses from room to room. And they were big and fragile, hard to amplify, often impossible to hear. Leo handed them something different. An instrument shaped more like a guitar. threaded and portable, amplified and precise. For the first time, bass players could know exactly where the note was. They could plug in and be heard, hold the bottom of the music with authority that it deserved. The low end of popular music simply shifted. Two instruments, two revolutions in 2 years, and Leo Fender kept drawing. The Stratocaster. By 1953, the Telecaster was selling. The precision bass was selling. Leo Fender could have stopped. Plenty of men simply would have. They would have protected what worked and guarded the success and milked the product. Told customers, you're lucky to have it. But Leo, he did the opposite. He listened to complaints. Again. The Telecaster was a great working guitar, but the body dug into the ribs and the strap pulled. The edges, they were sharp. The sound was bold, but some players wanted more range and more expression. Dare I say, more shimmer. They wanted to bend sound itself. So Leo went back to the drafting table. This time, he did not sit alone. Freddie Tavares worked beside him, a Hawaiian steel guitarist from Maui. A draftsman, a patient man. A man willing to draw a curve 50 times until the curve finally behaved. Together, they worked on a new guitar. Not merely a better Telecaster, something more futuristic. A body contoured to fit the player. A curve in the back for the belly. A curve in the front for the strumming arm. A double cutaway so the hand could reach higher frets. 3 pickups instead of 2. A floating bridge. Springs under the bridge. A tremolo arm so the people could bend all 6 strings at once. 6 tuning pegs all on one side of the headstock. A body that looked like it belonged not in the past, but in a chrome and tail fin future. Around this time, young players were pushing the volume harder. Dick Dale, the king of the surf guitar, came around the factory. He played loud, brutally loud. He blew up some of Leo's amplifiers. Now, Leo did not scold him. Leo went there to hear him. At the Rendezvous Ballroom in Balboa, thousands of teenagers packed into a room, swallowing volume with their bodies, and Leo simply watched and listened. He then identified the problem and did what he usually did, went back to the shop. He built a bigger amp. Dick Dale blew that one up too. So Leo built a bigger one, then a bigger one. A 15-inch JBL speaker. More power, more control. The Showman amp, the reverb tank. That was Leo Fender's world. A teenager on a stage breaking equipment. A man at a bench solving the breakage. In 1954, the Fender Stratocaster went on sale. $249.50. It looked like it had arrived from tomorrow. The body had motion even when it stood still. The sunburst finish faded from amber to dark red around the edges. The pickguard was white. The lines were confident. Some store owners didn't know what to do with it. Some even refused to stock it. Some, they hid it in the back. Some musicians picked it up and put it down confused. But others picked it up and did not put it down. Like Buddy Holly. He strapped one on. A teenage Eric Clapton saw Buddy Holly with a Stratocaster in a magazine in England, and something inside of him started moving. Jimi Hendrix would later take the Stratocaster and make it scream and pray and burn and cry, explode, and resurrect itself in front of an audience that did not yet know what electricity could even feel like. Eric Clapton would play Blackie. David Gilmour would play the Black Strat. Buddy Guy, Stevie Ray Vaughan, Mark Knopfler, Bonnie Raitt, John Mayer. Names, styles, decades, stages, genres. All bending sound through an instrument drawn by a man who could not play a chord. And where was Leo Fender? Well, he wasn't backstage soaking up praise. Not in the crowd with sunglasses. Not acting like he was royalty. Because he was at the factory, drawing. Because he was already thinking about the next problem. The sale. Sometime in the mid-1950s, Leo Fender began feeling sick. A sinus infection, and then worse. Strepsinitis. Antibiotics, more antibiotics. Nothing seemed to solve it. And the illness dragged on, year after year. The fumes in the factory did not help. The lacquer, the stress, the long hours. The weight of a company growing faster than the man could comfortably carry. He lost energy, he lost sleep, and he lost weight. Some mornings, just getting out of bed was a victory. Esther would bring coffee, and he would drink it slowly. Then go to the factory anyways, because drawings do not draw themselves. Problems do not solve themselves. And Leo Fender did not know how to be idle. By 1964, he believed that he was dying. Think about that. 55 years old. The company bearing his name had changed music forever. His instruments were already in the hands of working musicians across the country. But he was exhausted, sick, and convinced his time was nearly gone. So he began preparing. He tried to sell the company to Don Randall, $1.5 million. Randall simply could not get financing, so the company was shopped elsewhere. CBS stepped forward, Columbia Broadcasting Systems, a corporate giant, television, radio, Walter Cronkite, living rooms, American Authority. CBS wanted consumer markets. They had bought Steinway pianos. Women's Day Magazine, the New York Yankees. Now they wanted Fender. January 5th, 1965. The sale closed. $13 million. The man who had started with $600 borrowed from a Ford Model A had just sold his company for $13 million. Now that sounds triumphant, but imagine the room. A conference table and contracts and lawyers and pens. A fragile man with a glass eye and shaking health signing away the company that carried his name. His name would remain on the headstock, but it would no longer belong to him. Not truly. He signed, he went home and waited to die. Except he did not die. A few weeks later, Leo changed doctors and a new treatment and a different antibiotic, a different approach. And the infection? It cleared. Within a month, Leo Fender was healthy for the first time in years, and I'm talking fully healthy. And now comes the cruel comedy of fate. He had sold his life's work because he thought that he was dying. Well, then he recovered. He was 56 years old, $13 million in the bank, no company, no job, no factory that was his, no right to build under his own name. Imagine him standing at a window, looking at the orange trees, looking down at his hands. The same hands that drew the Telecaster. The same hands that drew the Stratocaster. The same hands that built the precision bass. Healthy hands and steady hands. And looking down and noticing that his hands had nothing to do. He went back to CBS and tried to buy the company back. CBS refused. Of course they refused. Fender was profitable. The brand was growing. The name on the headstock was now theirs. So what does Leo Fender do? Well, he goes home, walks into his garage, sits down at the drafting table and starts drawing again. His non-compete would stop him from selling guitars under his own name for years. Fine. Then he would not sell guitars. He would design. He would research. He would build quietly. He founded CLF Research. Clarence Leo Fender. The pencil moved again. The man could not stop. Esther, Music Man, and GNL. Through the late 60s and early 70s, Leo worked quietly. Pickups and bridges, tremolo systems, designs, ideas. In 1971, Forrest White and Tom Walker, old Fender associates, came to Leo Fender. They were starting a new company, and Leo helped. The name became Music Man. By 1975, his non-compete expired and Leo Fender became president of Music Man. A new beginning, a new bench. A new chance to solve new problems. The Stingray bass emerged, the first production bass with active electronics. Leo was in his mid-60s, still building, still refining, still chasing the next correction. And then came loss. In 1979, Esther died of cancer. 45 years of marriage. 45 years beside a man whose mind lived at the workbench and drafting tables. She had been there in the early shop. There through the flood, there through the risk, through the growth, through the illness, through the sale, through everything. And one day she was gone. There are losses no machine can fix. No tool can adjust. No drawing can resolve. You see, Leo Fender, the man who could repair almost anything, could not repair death. So he did what builders often do when grief is too large to face directly. He worked. Friends later introduced him to Phyllis Thomas, a widow, patient and kind. A woman who could understand that Leo Fender's love language was not grand speeches, but showing up at the bench. They married in 1980 on a cruise ship, the Love Boat. Leo Fender, 71 years old, newly married, afloat on a ship built for leisure. It almost sounds impossible. A man who spent his life in shops and factories and garages, sitting at a captain's dinners on a cruise. But even then, once the trip ended, he returned to the drafting table. That same year, he founded G&L, George and Leo. With George Fullerton and Dale Hyatt, a new factory, a new line of instruments, on a street in Fullerton renamed Fender Avenue. The man no longer owned the company called Fender, but he was still building on a street that carried his name. The ASAT, the Skyhawk, the Comanche. New pickups and new bridges, new ideas. Through the 1980s, while corporate Fender struggled under CBS ownership, Leo Fender quietly built some of the finest instruments of his life at G&L. He didn't brag about it, did not dance on anybody's grave. And in 1985, CBS sold Fender musical instruments back to its employees for $12.5 million. Half a million less than CBS paid Leo 20 years earlier. Leo did not need to say anything. The instrument said enough. The hands. In the late 1980s, Parkinson's disease had begun to take hold. For a man like Leo Fender, this was a particularly cruel theft. The hands. The hands that drew. The hands that measured. The hands that held tools. The hands that had turned ideas into usable things. They began to shake. At first, maybe a little, then a little more. Pencil lines became harder. Parts became harder to hold. The body had become less obedient. Assistants helped, and younger men held pieces steady while Leo pointed. He still came to work every single day. His wife, Phyllis, later went and said he went to the office every day until he died. That sentence should tell you everything that you need to know. Not once a week, not when he felt inspired, every single day, until the day before he died. Because for Leo Fender, work was not interpreted life. Work was life. March 21st, 1991. Leo Fender died at his home in Fullerton, California. He was 81 years old. A guitar he had been working on still sat unfinished on his bench. Sketches remained and pickups, notes, and ideas. The work was not done. Of course it wasn't. Men like Leo Fender never reach the end of their work. They simply run out of breath. When the family prepared him for burial, Phyllis made one specific request. He was to be buried in his work shirt with his pocket protector. And that may be the most perfect detail in the entire story. Because the most rock and roll thing about Leo Fender was that he was never rock and roll. He was not leather jackets and stage lights. He was not hotel rooms and screaming crowds. He was not swagger. He was a work shirt and a pencil and a pocket protector, a drafting table, a glass eye, and a quiet mind. A man who listened to musicians complain, then went back to the bench and changed the world for them. The rest of the story. Leo Fender was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1992. The world finally placed him among the giants of a genre he had never performed in. President George H.W. Bush awarded him the National Medal of Arts before he died. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame would say rock and roll as we know it today could never exist without Leo Fender. That is not an exaggeration. Buddy Holly and Jimi Hendrix, Eric Clapton, David Gilmour, Stevie Ray Vaughan, Bonnie Raitt, Mark Knopfler, The Beach Boys, The Eagles, Pink Floyd, Dire Straits. Country, blues, rock, surf, soul, and pop. Studio sessions and garage bands, stadiums and bars and bedrooms. Everywhere electricity meets ambition, Leo Fender is there. He's not standing in the light, but he's standing behind it. He's not playing the note, making sure that every note can survive. That is the story that people miss. Leo Fender did not change music because he played it better than anyone else. He changed music because he listened to it and to the people who could play it. He heard their frustrations and their limitations, their failures. Their late-night complaints at a repair counter in Fullerton, California. And he believed those complaints were not annoyances. They were instructions. A buzzing pickup was an instruction. A broken amplifier. A guitar feeding back. A bass nobody could hear. A player's sore ribs after they played too long. A blown speaker. They were all instructions. Every failure told him where to draw the next line. And that's how builders think. Not what is wrong with them. What is wrong with the system? Not why they can't adapt. Why hasn't the tool adapted to them? Somewhere, right now, a teenager is holding a Stratocaster for the first time. Maybe it's a hand-me-down. Maybe it's a Christmas gift. Maybe a guitar bought after a summer of mowing lawns and washing dishes or working at a drive-through window. Maybe she does not know about Leo Fender. Maybe he does not know about the bar. The orange groves, the glass eye, the flooded radio shop, the war years. Maybe Doc Kaufman or George Fullerton. Maybe the drafting table. The sale to CBS. The illness and the grief. The Parkinson's. The pocket protector. They only know this. When they plug in and the note rings out clean, somewhere else a studio engineer lifts a fader. A Telecaster track from a session 10 years ago cuts through the mix like it was recorded yesterday. Clean, sharp, certain. Somewhere a bass player locks into a groove on a precision bass, and the whole room stands on that low end without ever thinking about the man who made it possible. Somewhere a working guitarist walks into a bar, opens a case, and lifts out an instrument. He plugs it in and just knows that it's going to work. You see, that trust is Leo Fender's legacy. Not fame, not applause, but trust. The trust that when lights dim, when the crowd waits, when the drummer counts, when the night begins, the instrument will work and it'll be ready. Leo Fender, in his years, never learned to play guitar. But he taught the guitar how to survive the modern world. He did not write songs. He just simply gave them a body. He did not stand under the spotlight. He built what the spotlight revealed. He didn't chase music. He engineered the road that it would travel on. He was the man who could not play guitar. The man with one good eye who saw everything everybody else missed. The man with a pencil who redrew the sound of the 20th century. The man who proved that sometimes the person who changes an art form isn't the artist. It is the builder standing quietly behind them. The one listening, the one measuring, the one fixing. The one drawing late night into the night while the rest of the world sleeps. And now, when the guitar cuts through the smoke, when the note lands clean, when the room goes still, you know whose hands help put it there. My name is Mr. Hansen, and now you know the rest of the story. If you like this story and you want to hear more like it, go to MrHansenPodcast.com. That's MrHansenPodcast.com, and join us for all the cool stories that we're talking about.
Mr. Hansen on the mic, got that old truth in his throat. Said Leo came from dust on a California road. Little hands wiring fire in a room full of worn out parts. He heard a future buzz before it ever had a heart. From the fields to the bench, from the scars to the grain, he cut the wood clean, then he called it by name. Gave the boys a voice that could bite right through the night. Now every bent back dreamer plays a little meaner when it strikes. And the room got hot when the story turned. Every nail and screw had a lesson learned. Mr. Hansen leaned in close like he knew the cost. Said a man's good hands can still get lost. Leo Fender, burn on. Leo Fender, burn on. From the grave to the green, your name stays strong. Leo Fender, burn on. Leo Fender, burn on. Mr. Hansen tells it till the smoke is gone. He chased the cleanest line through the stubborn dark, built a second skin for a broken heart. Then the years came hard with the weight of the trade. Still the shape held true in the songs he made. Now the salt air rusts on the old shop door, and the band keeps time like a war on the floor. Mr. Hansen says, listen, every life gets due, from the first wild spark to the final blue. And the room got still as the ending came, even the old wood sighed at the final name. Mr. Hansen shook his head like a prayer turned rough. Said a man can leave, but he leaves enough. Leo Fender, burn on. Leo Fender, burn on. From the grave to the green, your name stays strong. Leo Fender, burn on. Leo Fender, burn on. Mr. Hansen tells it till the smoke is gone. Bone, from sweat to stone, he built a road, then walked it alone.
Mr. Hanson tells it till the smoke is gone.